From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The continued detention of my client Farouk Abdelmouti, as well as the recent pickup of Ammar Jibran, show a clear government strategy to silence dissent from the Palestinian-American community.
Today, we'll look at the case of Farouk Abdelmouti. The FBI raided his home when he was on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Weeks later, they picked him up. It's now more than 6 months later, and he's suing the federal government for his detention. We hope to speak with him from the detention center. We'll also be speaking with a spokesperson for the INS about the detentions of Palestinians, Pakistanis, and Somalis. And we'll look at the U.S. government's plan to monitor Iraqis in the United States. That's Iraqis, Iraqi Americans, and so-called Iraq sympathizers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian hospital officials say a senior UN relief worker has been shot dead in the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. A Reuters cameraman saw the body of the man after Israeli forces invaded and a gun battle broke out. Hospital officials tentatively identified him as Ian John Hawk, an Irish national who oversaw the building of homes for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. Meanwhile, Israeli troops invaded the city of Bethlehem early today. The Israeli attacks come after a Palestinian suicide bomber killed 7 adults and 4 children in Jerusalem yesterday. And the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv is reporting that a special rehabilitation village has been set up to take care of former Israeli combat soldiers who suffer from deep mental crises. 100 soldiers are currently undergoing treatment. Some suffer from nightmares and are unable to face up to having harmed civilians. A senior military officer said, quote, "The soldiers burst out crying and blame themselves for maltreatment, abuse, humiliation, and derision of the Palestinians. Now, after being discharged, the vision of what they had done is playing itself in their minds like a nonstop film," unquote. Before entering the treatment facility, dozens of soldiers became addicted to heroin and cocaine. Some tried committing suicide. NATO leaders meeting in Prague yesterday agreed to a controversial plan to build a new 20,000-strong multinational strike force. The NATO response force will be designed to fight far from NATO's traditional European areas of operations. The Bush administration has billed the force as its most important goal for a summit. President Bush, Secretary of State General Colin Powell, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, and White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card have all been at the summit. Andrew Card is famous for his comment about the war in Iraq, saying in September the reason they had not pushed it before was you don't roll out a new product in August. Critics say the White House will use the new NATO army to force European allies to pursue U.S. policies against al-Qaeda or so-called rogue states. The controversial plan also calls for investment into new military equipment, including so-called smart bombs and surveillance planes. Also yesterday, NATO agreed to invite Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia to join the alliance. United Press International is reporting the new members have already issued a strong statement of support for U.S. policy toward Iraq, reflecting U.S. hopes that the new members will be more supportive of the U.S. on the use of force. And today, NATO leaders reached out to the Central Asian nations, whose assistance proved vital in the U.S.-led war on Afghanistan. President Bush is visiting Russian President Vladimir Putin today in St. Petersburg. The meeting will focus on Russian concerns over the future of its booming trade ties with Iraq should the U.S. invade. Russia's worried about whether Russian oil companies will continue to have access to Iraq's oil fields. Baghdad also owes Moscow $7 billion in Soviet-era debt. In an interview broadcast on Russian TV, President Bush assured the Russians, quote, "We have no desire to run the show, to run the country. We understand that Russia has got interests there, as do other countries, and of course those interests will be honored. U.S. and British warplanes bombed two air defense radar sites in southern Iraq yesterday. On Wednesday, the warplanes bombed three air defense communications facilities. U.S. officials said yesterday Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri has been captured and is undergoing interrogation by the CIA at a secret location abroad. Officials allege he's a 15-year associate of Osama bin Laden and a key planner of the attack on the USS Cole and the 1998 embassy bombings in East Africa. 100 people have been stabbed, bludgeoned, or burned to death in Christian and Muslim rioting in the Nigerian city of Kaduna. Hundreds have been injured and thousands more have sought refuge in army bases and police stations. The rioting was triggered by a newspaper article suggesting Islam's founding prophet, Muhammad, might have chosen a wife from among the contestants in the Miss World beauty pageant in Nigeria. Contestants from five other countries are boycotting the pageant because Islamic courts in Nigeria have sentenced several unmarried women to death by stoning for conceiving outside wedlock. The Associated Press is reporting the ink is barely dry on the new Homeland Security Department legislation, but corporate lobbyists are already chasing the pot of gold it offers. The German-based contractor Siemens has started a political action committee and recruited budget experts to help its Homeland pitch. Microsoft has hired a former Coast Guard commander to oversee its bidding. Cerberus Capital Partners hired the Phoenix-based lobbying firm of former Vice President Dan Quayle. And several firms are creating special units to help companies compete for the billions in new national security spending. Investment bank Morgan Stanley has outraged unions by telling clients to pull their money out of heavily unionized industries. In a research note circulated to North American clients last Thursday, analysts advise look for the union label, then run the other way. The analysts describe pension plans as, quote, toxic for shareholders and argued that union firms are more likely to provide retirement and health care benefits that could eat into corporate profits.
Do you want a society where the people are only one color? Do you want a society full of oppression and racism? Do you want the children to live in hunger in the streets? Do you want the people deprived of their liberty?
Mba, 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 hey. Mba, 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 hey.
I am so angry, so full of rage. I cannot express the fear I have inside.
Today we chose 100 backward steps. Today we chose greed over integrity. Today we chose hate for equality. Today we took 100.
Copper Woman, No 187. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And welcome to all of our listeners around the country. And this, the 39th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a crime that many Americans still has not been solved. And, of course, the crimes continue, the unsolved crimes continue across the country.
Juan, last week we spoke to you just before you were headed to Washington for a debate at the National Press Club. How'd it go? And talk
about
what you debated.
Well, the debate turned out very well. It was a packed house at the National Press Club. A C-SPAN televised it live. It was about a 90-minute debate, actually.
And we'll be broadcasting it next week.
And I think I pretty much demolished my opponent, William McGowan. But you'd have to judge for yourself by looking at the actual tape.
Talk about the book he wrote and why you did this debate.
Well, McGowan published a book which is called last year called "Coloring the News: How the Crusade for Diversity has corrupted American Journalism." And basically, it's all about how American journalism started going downhill as soon as all the blacks and Latinos and Asians and women and gay reporters were hired in large numbers. And he pins all of the problems of American journalism on political correctness and the caving in of the liberal media to activists in the African American, Latino, feminist community, and I think that so it was. It was normally we would ignore the book, but then the National Press Club gave it its award for press criticism for the year. And at that point, when that happened, many of the minority journalist organizations in the country raised a stink, and we in the Hispanic journalists demanded a public debate at the press club since they were giving the award, which finally did occur Monday night. And I think it was instructive. You know, it's what's happened increasingly now. You're seeing all of these books come out. The Goldberg book on broadcast news. You're seeing all of these books attacking the liberal media. Of course, all of us know that the liberal media is a figment of a lot of people's imagination, and that this is really a sort of a because McGowan's book was financed by the Bradley Foundation. He's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, by the Olin Foundation. So these are some of the most extreme right-wing think tanks and foundations in the country, all trying to create another front of attack to basically intimidate the corporate media, as if it needed any more intimidation, into not covering important issues or issues that are of controversy, and basically falling more in line with the extreme right in the country in terms of their news coverage. So I think it was important to stand up to it, to expose the guy, because his scholarship is terrible. The book is dishonest, it's fraudulent, and yet it purports to be a comprehensive study. It goes through all kinds of cases, the L.A. Ramparts case, a police brutality case in L.A., the Amadou Diallo case, the Elisa Izquierdo case, the Crown Heights riots, and goes through a bunch of the major domestic big news stories of the past 10 years, and attempts to show how in each case the liberal media covered up the real story. Same thing with immigration and with attacks on gays. So it's a terrible, terrible book.
Well, we are going to broadcast excerpts of that debate next week. You just mentioned immigrants, and today we're going to focus on immigrants, and we're going to especially look at immigrants who are threatened with detention, have been detained, or have been deported. The New York Times is reporting the government has been secretly monitoring thousands of Iraqi citizens and Iraqi Americans. Bush administration officials also warned the government will detain Iraqis or Iraq sympathizers in the event of a U.S. invasion of Iraq. Senior government officials say they're monitoring in an effort to identify potential domestic terrorist threats posed by sympathizers of the Baghdad regime. The previously undisclosed intelligence program involves tracking thousands of Iraqi citizens and Iraqi Americans with dual citizenship who are attending U.S. universities or working at private corporations. The officials say some of the targets of the operation are being electronically monitored under the authority of national security warrants. Others are being selected for recruitment as informers. In the event of a U.S. invasion of Iraq, officials will arrest and detain Iraqis or Iraq sympathizers if they're believed to be planning domestic terrorist operations. We're joined now by Anas Shalal. He is an Iraqi-American who is a partner for peace with the Seeds of Peace program, one of the founders of the Mesopotamia Cultural Society and business owner in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Can you talk first about this plan exposed by the New York Times last Sunday?
Well, I mean, it's probably a good thing today because your listenership has probably gone up. Being that I'm calling and talking to you, I guess I could assume that my phone is being monitored at this point. But it's very distressing, I think, for Iraqi Americans. I think for many people, not just the Iraqi American community here, most of us come to this country to avoid this kind of stuff, and it's happening to us here again. I think Iraqi Americans in particular have been sort of hit with a double whammy. After 9/11, Arab Americans were being scrutinized greatly, and now Iraqi Americans have the second layer of scrutiny that they have to adhere to.
Can you talk about first of all, what is meant by officials saying some of the targets of the operation are being electronically monitored under the authority of national security warrants?
Well, I think, you know, the FBI had a meeting with Arab American leaders just a few days ago here in Washington, D.C., and they wanted to assure us that things are okay and that we don't have anything to worry about, that this is really for the good of everyone and so on. And I can understand some of the concerns, obviously, that sort of came up, that they brought up. But somebody mentioned at the meeting, he says, you know, you're asking us to get married. We haven't even gone on a first date yet. You know, the idea that the FBI has all of a sudden become our good friend seems rather a stretch. And most Arab Americans, Iraqi Americans, most Americans don't have the full faith of the FBI and feel that oftentimes they're being scrutinized unjustly when the FBI is listening in on them.
And have you been able to tell from Iraqi civic groups or Iraqi American groups in this country that whether they are actually already noticing this enormous increase in surveillance and interference in their activities?
Well, the one thing we're definitely noticing is that Iraqis are speaking less, and that definitely is an effect this kind of fear. At the time when Iraqis should speak out more, because they may have some insights, they may have some ideas about what's going on and give us a whole different perspective on this, I believe, misguided war, they're really being shut down. And that's, I guess, part of the reason, is because they're the ones that really are the ones that we should look to and look for information to. The Iraqi-American community in general, I think the one thing that has not been brought up is that Iraqi-Americans are not for this war, and this has not been clearly disseminated in the press. They really have not been asked and not put in front of the limelight in order to speak up, because they're the ones that would know.
How large is the Iraqi and Iraqi American community?
The estimates really sort of vary greatly, but anywhere between 300 and 400,000 people here in the United States, with most of the areas of concentration in Detroit and San Diego, California.
And when did people come here?
The Detroit group, which is the Christian Iraqis, have been here for probably over 100 years. But there's other groups that are new immigrants, and you know, they've been coming here on an ongoing basis since probably maybe 30, 40 years ago.
And this issue of Iraqi sympathizers, that could basically be any organization that is opposing the war, the proposed war against Iraq, couldn't it?
Sure. I don't think it just includes Iraqi Americans, but it includes anyone that's opposed to the war. You know, we've been fed so much misinformation that any information that comes out ends up to be, information that comes out that doesn't fall in line with the Pentagon or the White House becomes suspect. You become a suspicious target. There's an interesting article that just came out, and if I may share this with your listeners, an article in I don't know if you're familiar with yellowtimes.org, which is a very good website I'd like to refer people to. A guy by name of Imad al-Khaduri, who is a nuclear scientist that had defected from Iraq in 1998. Had been working in the Iraq nuclear weapons program since 1968, and clearly states that there is no nuclear weapons program at this time, that's all gone, it's all been dismantled since 1998 when the UN inspectors left. He has some very good credentials, holds a PhD from England, and works in Canada, but you don't see him often on the news to speak out.
And that website again is yellowtimes.org?
Yes.
There was a piece in the Christian Science Monitor yesterday, front page, headlined U.S. Forms Iraqi Opposition, with promises of $3,000 and a trip to America. The U.S. is quietly recruiting inside northern Iraq, part of a new 5,000-man force to help topple Saddam Hussein. But Iraqi opposition leaders say that the U.S. is creating a military force for the controversial Iraqi National Congress, which has little support in Iraq, one of six opposition groups that Washington is encouraging to come up with a plan for ruling a post-Hussein Iraq. Your response?
the Iraqi National Congress is, really has no credibility in Iraq or elsewhere. I think the only place that it has any credibility is in the Pentagon, the White House. They're run by a guy by name of Ahmed Al-Chalabi, and you've done some work on that, Amy, I think, who is an embezzler. He's a convicted felon. Had been run out of Jordan for embezzlement and went into hiding in London. And now he surfaced to be the new Iraqi savior, the hero.
And can you say again your response or people you know that federal authorities planning to begin interviewing Arab Americans, asking them to report suspicious activity related to Iraq, telling people the interviews are voluntary, your response to that?
Well, the AAI, the Arab American Institute, and the ADC, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, have made it very clear that anyone that gets contacted has to know that they have rights here in this country, and they have to be able to exercise them if so needed. So the fact that these interviews are voluntary may not be so voluntary once you start saying things that may be used against you. So, people need to be very aware that should they be contacted, that they should contact a lawyer or someone that can sit with them and be able to answer the questions accordingly. But, I think the one thing that this has caused is it may or may not be happening, and may or may not be happening a lot to a lot of people, but it certainly has put a chill within the community. And I think most people feel very uncomfortable now speaking out about these issues and certainly publicly.
And as an Iraqi American, when you hear all of the statements from the Bush administration in relationship to these no-fly zones and the British planes and American planes being attacked by Iraq for violating in attempts to attack them in the no-fly zones. Of course, the American people hear very little about how the rest of the international community doesn't recognize these no-fly zones. But could you, your response to that?
Well, I think they're trying to create a sense that the no-fly zones are UN sanctioned, and that the whole world is sort of back these things. But the fact is, the no-fly zones were imposed by the British and the Americans against. Just in direct confrontation with Iraq, and the bombings that have been happening are just provocations, I think, to try to lure Iraq into something bigger, so that they can have a pretext to an all-out war. I just feel that we've become sort of our government is out of control, and we've sort of become a society out of control. If we want action, we want it now. And anything that's going to sort of draw that in is what we're looking for.
And finally, your response to Saddam Hussein, your thoughts about him.
Well, you'll be very hard-pressed to find many sympathizers to Saddam Hussein, certainly not within the Iraqi-American community that's here living in the United States. Most of us are living here for the freedoms that this country offers, and when you start taking away these freedoms, we start sort of questioning, are we really better off here? Saddam Hussein needs to go. I think a lot of Iraqis recognize that and would like to have that happen. But what's happened is, in the past few years, after the Iran-Iraq war and the sanctions, which has been an ongoing war against the Iraqi people since 1991, they have created so much hardship for the people that they've put much of the blame against the West, the United States in particular, and really have done nothing but made Saddam Hussein stronger and more powerful and more in control. And the Iraqi people have suffered continuously. Mortality rates are up four times. Almost a million people have died since the beginning of the sanctions. And they really put the blame squarely in the lap of the United States. And so the credibility that the U.S. had at one time to be able to go and save the Iraqi people has been squandered.
Well, Anas Shalal, I want to thank you for being with us, Iraqi American, founder of the Mesopotamia Cultural Society and business owner in Washington, D.C. It's a shame to say these days that a simple conversation like this is very brave of you to participate in, but thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Democracy Now! We are monitoring our lines throughout this show, waiting to hear from prisoner, a detainee at a jail, and we'll break in when we do hear from him. We're going to go to break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking to the INS, we'll be speaking to a UPI reporter, and we'll be talking with a Pakistani immigrants' rights activist about another mass deportation of Pakistanis that have occurred this past week. Stay with us.
Ducky would close his eyes and cry bittersweetly and wonder who possibly could be to blame. Was it foreign neighbors whose ethnic behavior would finally cause us all hard to give in? Negroes or flamers, beatniks or ravens, whole generations are spreading their sin. Was it pinkos or lefters, the equally sexist, the death of an era that no one could save? Children, better off with you buried underground than up here, better off with you buried underground than up here, raising children, better off with you buried underground.
Requiem for a Bitter Man, talking out loud here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is the War and Peace Report. 87 Pakistanis from across the United States were deported on Wednesday from Buffalo, New York. According to a report in the Pakistan Daily Times, the detainees were arrested by the FBI and other law enforcement agencies. This is the third wave of mass deportations of Pakistanis this year. Human Rights Watch reported earlier this year that many detainees have been incarcerated and treated as criminals. The report says, quote, persons detained on immigration charges or on material witness warrants are not accused of criminal conduct, much less convicted of it. Nevertheless, detainees held in connection with the September 11th investigation have been treated as though they were convicted terrorists. We're joined right now by several people to talk about this latest news of the Pakistanis. As well, we hope to go to Seattle to find out what has happened with a group of Somalis who the government planned to deport but somehow was thwarted in its efforts. We turn first to Anwar Iqbal, who is a UPI analyst for South Asian Affairs. His article, U.S. Boots 87 Pakistanis, came out yesterday. It seems to be the only Western news source on the deportation of the 87 Pakistani detainees on Wednesday. Can you tell us what happened, what you were able to find out in your research, Anwar Iqbal?
Hi.
Hi.
These were the Pakistanis who were arrested by INS basically for violation of immigration laws. Most of them were what the INS calls deportee absconders, i.e., people who have been tried by American courts and ordered to leave the country but failed to do so. But when I spoke to some of the detainees, they said that there were many among them who were not deportee absconders. They were the ones who were arrested after 9/11 on suspicions of terrorism, and although none of them were found involved in terrorist activities, they were deported nonetheless.
Now, and these 87 Pakistanis were picked up in all over the country in different places?
From all over the country, yes. This is a third batch. There were two more, one in July and one in August, and all of them were arrested from all over the United States.
Now, in terms of the focus on Pakistanis, clearly most of the hijackers in the attack on the World Trade Center were Saudis. We have a report just in today's papers about a chief operative Al-Qaeda, also a Saudi. But yet the focus seems to be in terms of the U.S. dragnet on all sorts of other countries except Saudi Arabia.
That is true, and that is what the Pakistanis find very upsetting. Some of the detainees were saying that although our soldiers have died fighting Al-Qaeda and trying to catch Al-Qaeda and Taliban fugitives, and yet this is how we are treated.
We are also joined on the phone by Pramila Jayapal. She's executive director and founder of Hate Free Zone Campaign of Washington State. She's the author of Pilgrimage to India, A Woman Revisits Her Homeland. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer ran a story on Saturday that goes something like this. Muhammad Awais says he was foolish to overstay his visa, but he does not want to die because of it. Ahmed Noor Yusuf is also a refugee from Somalia. He has similar fears. He hopes the United States can find a way to send him back to northern Somalia and not war-torn Mogadishu in the south. The two men are among five Somali men the INS in Seattle is detaining. They await deportation to a homeland that their attorneys say doesn't exist. With no government and no officials to accept the men, attorneys argue, the five men should not be deported to Somalia. Pramila Jayapal, can you talk about what is happening with Somalis in Washington?
Sure. About 7 days ago, we received notice from a number of different individuals in the community that there had been a roundup of a number of men who were out on Somali men who were out on final orders of supervision, which means that they had final orders of deportation, but they were allowed to be released and to be active in the community because they didn't pose any threat to the society and because the government could not affect their deportation back to Somalia. The INS took them into detention again, and they were told that their deportation was going to be imminent. We were able to gather a team of attorneys together from a top law firm to represent them and file a habeas petition in federal court, which basically we were granted a TRO from the judge, who agreed that that there should be a stay against their deportation. Those men are still in detention right now, but their deportation has been stayed until there is a preliminary injunction hearing, which is not going to happen until January. Basically, our claim is that the deportation of these men cannot be affected. We're actually not challenging the underlying orders of deportation at this point. We are just saying that there is a congressional statute that must be followed for every person who is going to be deported. And that process is a three-step process, and it involves obtaining the acceptance of the government of the country to which the person is going to be deported. And in Somalia, there is no functioning government. And that's, you know, our State Department agrees that there's no functioning government. If these men are sent back, they most likely will be killed or suffer great harm. And we don't think that we are challenging the lawfulness of the deportation.
Well, let's bring Bill Strasburger into the conversation, public affairs officer with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, primary spokesperson for INS asylum, refugee, and immigration law issues. Your response?
Well, a number of issues raised. Where do I begin? As far as the removals, the priority of the agency is the removal of criminals from the United States. These are people that are here. In many cases, they are here illegally. Sometimes they are here as legal permanent residents who have violated the nation's laws and have been convicted to serve their time, but as a result are no longer allowed to remain in the United States. In the case of Pakistanis, for instance, the number being removed is relatively small in the overall scheme. We removed last year, somewhere in the order of 177,000 people. Of that number, 334 were Pakistani, and about 25% of those were criminals. The rest were non-criminals, and that's fairly typical as far as percentages go. Pakistanis don't represent a large number, but they are part of it. Same thing is true with Somalis. There's a relatively small number who are being removed, but they are not, by and large, innocent victims. They are people who have violated the country's immigration laws at a minimum, and in many cases they have violated criminal. They're people who have been committed of things that ranging from fraud and larceny and drug offenses to armed robbery, assault, arson, sexual assaults. I feel for them in being sent back to countries that maybe they no longer want to be in, but at the same time they've given up their right to be here by violating the country's laws. And in those cases where they've overstayed their visas, they had an opportunity. They came here as temporary visitors in most cases, but they have overstayed. In most cases, we're talking about, I think, with these, they've overstayed and they've gone against the word that they gave when they were admitted into the United States of not intending to remain here.
Well, Bill Strasburger, what about, we've had several segments on this issue, and we've often heard of reports of people picked up and then disappearing to their lawyers, to their family members, within the, once they're in custody. Now, you can argue that, well, they violated their stays, but what about the whole issue of the due process that occurs with many of these, especially now post-September 11th, with many folks from Middle Eastern countries?
Mm-hmm. Well, to be honest with you, as far as anyone who's come into INS custody, they have been afforded due process. No one is removed from the United States without a final order of removal. That means they go before an immigration judge. They have the ability to appeal that to the Board of Immigration Appeals and even take it into federal court if they so choose. They have not been held incommunicado. You know, again, let's keep in mind we're talking about the immigration part. I can't address what may have happened with other agencies, if that's taking place, which I'd like to believe it isn't. But with immigration, in the immigration arena, they do have access. The law does not provide them automatically with attorneys. They do have the right to get an attorney to represent them. We do provide lists of pro bono attorneys for these people as they go forward. In some cases, they are able to get, and sometimes they're not. But as far as anyone not having access or not being available, it's not always the most convenient terms, I'll admit. It depends upon the where they're being detained, whether the case is on appeal. Sometimes they'll be moved from a short-term detention center to a long-term detention center. So there are a variety of factors. It's hard to talk in general terms, but if there's a specific scenario, I might be able to address that.
Pramila Jayapal, your response?
My response is that, first of all, there are two categories of people who are in deportation. One is people who have been denied asylum. And many of those, as Bill said, many of those do not have access to attorneys. The statistics say that about 80 to 85% of people who go through the INS system are pro se. They're unrepresented. The second category of people who are in deportation are those who have committed crimes, yes, but I think we must look at the fact that the INS is a civil system. It's not a criminal system. These people who have committed crimes often have committed very minor crimes, maybe, you know, taking a leather jacket from Nordstrom's or something, and they've paid their time in the criminal system, and then they're going to be deported. And again, we have to ask, you know, is it a fair treatment to deport somebody to their death, essentially, in the case of Somalia, for a relatively minor crime? So I think that's important to look at. I think the statistic you gave is that 25% of the Pakistanis have criminal convictions. We find the same thing with the Somalis. Many of these people do not have criminal convictions. And regardless of their conviction history, the statute on deportations is very clear. It applies to everybody, regardless of any criminal convictions, you still must go through a three-step process. The government still must accept people back into the country. So in the case of the Somalis, again, it's a slightly different situation. We're able to challenge the deportations in these cases. And I want to mention that the same situation came up in Minneapolis in the spring of this year, and a federal court judge did rule that the deportations of Somalis was unlawful. Unfortunately, what we have to do in each of these cases is file a habeas petition in court that names specific defendants. That means that the INS can then turn around and deport others, which is what they did in Minneapolis. A couple of weeks after the decision came down, they actually deported a number of other, I think it was 30 Somalis, back to Somalia. One of those people was murdered upon reaching Somalia. That was reported in a BBC News report. And another, whose wife still remains here, had to flee to a neighboring province and is living a life of great hardship there. So I think that this is an issue that, unfortunately, a habeas petition is not a class petition, and we're going to have to, I guess, fight each individual case. We found out just earlier this week, actually, that there are 12 Somalis in Louisiana who are under the same situation. We were able to file a habeas petition on behalf of one of them. But the lawyers in Minneapolis are actually challenging the deportation of the 30 Somalis that were sent back, or some of them. And they're saying that the INS is displaying a grave disregard for federal court decisions that have already been passed.
I wanted to bring Bobby Asanullah Khan into this discussion, who is a Pakistani immigrant rights activist with the Coney Island Avenue Project, talking about the latest deportation of 87 Pakistani detainees. Since we do have Bill Strasburger, Public Affairs Officer of the INS, on the line, can you talk about the concerns as you're at a detention facility as we speak, visiting? Bobby Khan, are you there? Bobby Khan, are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Right now I'm sitting in front of the Hudson County Detention Center. With respect, I heard the spokesperson of the INS. I disagree what he's saying. My point is that, they have deported thousands of Pakistanis and Muslims, and they have arrested, and people are still, thousands of people are still in the jails. I want to know, if they have found, especially from in the Pakistani community, anybody has any relation, any connections with terrorism, while this is based on after September 11. The other thing is that, there are no, I have dealt with about 150 detainees so far. Our project has dealt with this number. And we haven't found not a single person having any criminal charge except these minor immigration violations. And especially, those were ignored before some time. They had applied for the political asylum petition. They had applied for in order to obtain some legal status, they had applied for the adjustment of status. They had the persecution risk back home, and all these petitions were denied based on I don't know what. But these are the grounds that people are being denied their adjustment of status over here. These are hardworking people and very low income earner and very low wage earner people, and They're really, really innocent people, and the way they are arresting them is really very harsh. I can quote that they have no respect for the families, they have no respect for the kids. They would throw their parents in front of their kids. They would curse them and they would abuse them. They would not allow them even to wear their shoes or shirts. So these are the situations we are handling, and especially the NYPD is collaborating with INS, FBI is collaborating with the INS database, and what all this is going on, and especially they are going into the marked neighborhoods of Pakistanis and Muslims, asking about the Pakistanis and Muslims. I mean, they would go to the businesses and would ask about the Pakistanis, and they would go to the apartment buildings, would ask about the Muslims and Pakistanis. This is clearly a racial profiling. I mean, this is what they are doing. I mean, we want to know, I mean, what their response is upon this.
Yes, well, if we can ask Bill Strasberg to respond to that, both in terms of the issue of the treatment of folks as they are apprehended, and also as to the issue that was raised about whether any Pakistanis who have been picked up have actually been accused of being involved in any kind of terrorism.
Well, actually, you've raised a few points. Let me address these before we move on. First off, as far as respect to the families, we do have respect to the families. I think any allegations of abuse that may be made, there are avenues to file complaints if it's found that abuse has taken place, that disrespect has taken place. It will be addressed. To make the accusations but then not follow through by filing a complaint either with INS or with the Department of Justice is really unfair. We hear this many times, and we do follow through. People can receive all sorts of sanctions. They could go as far as to be removed from their job, fired, and occasionally even be charged with a crime. So let's be careful with the accusations of abuse, because there are we do have respect. If it's not, if someone feels that they have faced abuse, we want to hear about it. We want to deal with it. Unfortunately, there are times where people will be picked up at their job or in front of their family. That's not our first choice. Normally, when that is taking place, it's because the person has decided to ignore in order to report, and we have to go out and pick them up. If someone who is notified that they are to be removed does come forward voluntarily, they can we'll work with them. On the other hand, if they choose to ignore the order or choose to hide from us, they may find themselves in an embarrassing situation at the time that they're taken into custody. As far as racial profiling, that is not the case. We get this accusation, and again, given the number of nationalities, the number of ethnicities, and the number of races that we deal with on a daily basis, we would just not be able to stay in business. We'd spend our whole time in court facing charges.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll be back with you, Bill Strasberg, a public affairs officer for the INS, along with Bobby Khan, a Pakistani immigrant rights activist who is at a detention center right now. Also joined on the line by Pramila Jayapal, executive director and founder of Hate Free Zone Campaign of Washington, as well as the UPI reporter who did the piece on the secret deportation of 87 Pakistanis this week as they were gathered from around the country and deported from Buffalo, New York. Anwar Iqbal, UPI analyst for South Asian Affairs. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Come with me, come with me, and do from a dream in which her lover had denied himself her own true love, heeding not her hot salt tears, he turned her towards the door. And as she went,
okay. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Ballad of the Lonely, Copper Women, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk about the deportation and detention of immigrants, we have on the line with us right now Farouk Abdelmouti, a Palestinian activist detained after September 11th, says he must be allowed to stay in the U.S. because as a Palestinian, there's no nation where he can be deported to. He was originally arrested on the morning of April 26 by three New York police officers and an INS agent, all dressed in civilian clothes, came to the Queens apartment he was in without a warrant, he says. He joins us on the line from the detention facility. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Farouk Abdelmouti.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes.
Thank you very much
to IB in the line. Thank you to Democracy Now! Thank you to you. And thank you to everybody from the WBI Radio Pacifica. I have the honor to be here in your line. I feel myself part of the activism in the United States in this, by the soul of Martin Luther King and the soul of Haj Abbas, Malcolm X. The native activist in the United States and from the abroad, for the soul of Abu Jihad, Ghassan Kanafani, and from the Palestinian side and from the international side, Frank Pais from Cuba and others, what is fighting for right and justice.
Can you tell us where you are right now?
Yes. Hello?
Where are you right now, Farouk?
I am in Passaic County Jail.
Passaic County Jail,
I am in door
New Jersey.
2G3. Everybody is witness here and support the WBI Radio Pacifica and listen all the voices. We have five transistors here. Some brother from Marrakesh got a transistor in his hands. Some Egyptian brother from Guyanese, some Jamaican and Trinidadian brothers want to listen to the voice of WBI Radio Pacifica.
And they are all listening to WBAI right now in the detention center. Farouk, I am here.
This place from August after I be changed for three different jails.
Well, I'm here with Juan Gonzalez.
Farouk, I'd like to ask you, we have also right now we're interviewing Bill Strasburger, a spokesman for the INS, and he says that the INS has not been mistreating any of the people that it's picked up. You have now been incarcerated for 6 months. Could you talk a little bit about what's happened in your case and why you're still being held?
Well, in my case, in 7 months, what is in jail, now in this moment, past the 6 months, I never see a judge, and the case is in the hand of the lawyer Joel Kupferman. What his telephone number is 212-334-5531, and he is making heavy corpus petition. What is going to talk about my rights to be got my freedom? Yes.
Well, Bill Strasburger, what about this holding a person for more than 6 months and they still have not seen a judge?
I don't know the specifics on his case, so I couldn't. I couldn't address that. Normally, when someone is taken into custody, they are taken. They are scheduled on the docket with the immigration courts, and go before the judge, have a chance to plead their case. Why it's taken so long for him, I just can't say. It's unusual that someone would take that long, but it's not impossible. Again, I don't know if he is on a final order or what the circumstances are.
Let's talk about the circumstance for a minute. I do believe this is probably the first time that an INS spokesperson has been on a live national broadcast with a detainee in a detention facility. Farouk Abdelmouti on the line with us from Passaic County Jail has been held for more than 6 months. Not clear what the charges are, has not been brought before Judge Max Scott in the studio with us, part of his defense team. Can you explain what the reasons are you're bringing a lawsuit on behalf of Farouk?
Well, it's interesting. I wonder if Mr. Strasburger has heard of the Supreme Court of the United States, which ruled in Zedivitas.
Let's keep it civil, please.
Which ruled in Zedivitas that a detainee shouldn't be held more than 6 months if the state cannot effectuate their deportation. Farouk has a deportation order against him, but he's Palestinian. He's stateless. There is nowhere to deport him to. He's very similar to the Somali cases, which were being talked about earlier. And the United States is also a signatory to the UN Convention on Stateless Persons. Under that convention, they should be allowing Mr. Abdelmouti, my client, to settle here in the United States, to assimilate into American society. It's our contention that the INS is not holding true to the law, that is illegally detaining Mr. Abdelmouti and many other people.
Okay, I'm very familiar with the Zavadas decision that you refer to. It actually The decision came down that if we, once a final order has been issued, after 90 days, if we've not been able to effect the removal, then we can consider them for release, depending on the circumstances. Again, I don't know the circumstances of his case, why it's taking place, but from what you said, he does apparently have a final order of removal. Even in the case of those people who cannot be removed because of the country will not take them back or because we're having difficulty getting travel documents to do so, they still face removal from the United States. They're not going to be allowed to remain here ultimately once we're able to remove them from the country. They have forfeited that right by nature of either, well, the immigration judge in ordering the final order has taken care of that, but it's either on the virtue of the crime they were convicted of or the fact that they do have no legal immigration status in the country and the ability to remain here.
But what the case does make clear is that they're supposed to be released after 6 months.
No, not everyone is. It depends upon the circumstances. If they're considered a flight risk or if they are considered a danger to the community, in some cases we can continue to hold someone. Again, I can't get into specifics of his case. I'm just not familiar with them. I didn't know we'd be talking about this, otherwise probably could have found out. But the bottom line is that, yes, the Supreme Court did say that if we're unable to make that removal within 90 days of a final order being issued, they should be considered for release pending their final removal from the United States.
Farouk, let me bring him in since we only have a minute to go, and we do have him in the Passaic Detention Facility.
Sure.
Your last comments of your conditions there, I know one of the things you've been doing is trying to get names out of people who are detained because John Ashcroft and the Justice Department have remained steadfast in not wanting the names of detainees out. Can you describe the conditions and if you want to make a statement to the INS spokesperson?
Hello?
Yes.
Well, my condition here is terrible. I lose weight. The doctor don't see me. I have high blood pressure. Yes, he take my blood, you know, like bats. In the first jail, what I was, is called him Middlesex County, take 2 tubes of blood. Change me for Camden, Camden jail, he's taken me another 2 tubes of blood. And now this Passaic County jail, he's taken me 2 tubes of blood. And in change of this, he's given me just a Motrin for the pain of what I think I have in arthritis. And give me some medicine, high blood pressure. Sometime I stay 1 week without the medicine. And I have the problem of beginning to be bleeding. I don't know from what, from the stress or something. And the service, the clinic service is terrible, you know. And my condition when I see in this place, what is a jail, is rented by the INS. This jail belongs to the inmates, prisoners, and rented here 3 dorms. And I am part of these people. I suffering. When I see myself, I feeling like Dante O'Hare when he's write the Divine Comedy, and to go in between these stages, and the stage of our situation is critical, and my situation in person is critical, and I sharing the situation with all the detainees, victim of 9/11, and all the detainees, victim in general. From the immigration, from the INS, you know, the right of political asylum, many people ask is denied. Some people here is sick and very big, very can even see the doctors. The INS do it many wrong things, kidnap people and send it to his country, like Ibrahim Nasreddin from Ethiopia was kidnapped.
Farouk, we're going to have to leave it at that.
The situation here is I can't take it no more because really I see the mafia people. He's going to the jail and he's leaving as bad a situation we are.
I have to say goodbye to you now. We will continue to follow your case. Farouk Abdelmouti at the Passaic Detention Facility, held for more than 6 months at this point, a Palestinian. We've been joined on the phone also by Bill Strasburger, Public Affairs Officer of the INS, and Max Scott on the defense team of Farouk Abdelmouti. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.